Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We're going to spend some time with Thomas Harvey. He's the co-founder of Arch City Defenders, a civil rights advocacy organization. At the end of the year, he's leaving St. Louis for California, where he'll be working to establish a national voice for poor people held in jail because they can't afford bail. Arch City Defenders has an established record here by providing legal advocacy for the poor and has been active on the issue of municipal court reform post-Ferguson. Thomas Harvey joins me in studio. Great to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks so much for the invitation.
You're not leaving until January, as I understand, so this may or may not be an exit interview. Why are you leaving St. Louis?
I mean, first and foremost, my wife lives in California, and we've been in separate cities. Sheridan and I have been in separate cities for the last 8 years, and I've got an opportunity to do work in California with the Bail Project, which is founded by Robin Steinberg, who's the founder of the Bronx Defenders, and we are inspired by the Bronx Defenders in New York, and she contacted me about this amazing opportunity, and Robin's husband also lives in Los Angeles, so last couple of years, she and I have been talking about ways to work together, and this is an incredible opportunity to set up community bail funds in 40 cities across the country and hopefully work with community organizers and activists and bail out 150,000 people who are sitting in jail just because they can't make a cash payment in pretrial detention in the next 5 years.
I guess you're not starting this project from scratch then, that it is underway. You're just going to try to expand it. Is that it?
No, it's a brand new project.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah. We are launching the first sites. The first sites will be in St. Louis and Tulsa and in Bronx, where they have an existing bail fund that will turn into a site of the Bail Project.
Didn't the city just recently make a move to change its bail procedure?
In the city municipal court,
yeah.
My understanding, yeah. And also the city of St. Louis has been discussing piloting their own small bail fund to bail people out, because even the Department of Corrections here recognizes that there are many people sitting in jail who are not a threat to their community and who would already be returned to their community if they simply had the money to do it.
Where are you going to get the money? You're talking millions of dollars to do what you want to do.
We're incredibly fortunate. This is money that has been donated by a couple of very wealthy individuals. They heard of Robin's work over the last 10 years at the Bronx Freedom Fund and approached her about this opportunity. And she went through a vetting process, and a handful of incredibly generous, incredibly wealthy people have decided that they're going to throw their money at this one area.
What you'll be doing is not totally unlike some of the things you've been doing here, particularly with regard to municipal court reform.
That's right. A lot of this work is, in fact, I would say that what we have done in St. Louis with St. Louis Action Council, Kayla Reed and Kennard Williams at Moore and Decarcerate, is essentially the model that we're going to try to expand over the rest of the country. We know that getting people out of jail isn't the end for the folks who have been sitting in jail for a while. They're going to need follow-on services, and that's at an individual level. They're going to need a lot of support. In addition to that, just getting people out of bail doesn't fix the way the criminal legal system criminalizes poverty and race. And so the Bail Project will have an opportunity to collect data on a massive level that we think can be plugged into reform efforts, much in the same way that when, you know, Moore and Decarcerate have a campaign to shut down the workhouse and Arch City Defenders brings a lawsuit that adds on to that work, and Kayla Reed has a campaign to end cash bail in St. Louis, and we can collaborate with them and get folks out and help them with the services so that she can use those stories to further her own campaign. So that's what we're going to be trying to do all over the country.
There is a tendency here and obviously elsewhere to have people sit around in jail for a long time awaiting trial if they don't have the dollars to get out on bail.
That's right. And I think for a lot of folks who are just becoming aware of the way this system works, they don't understand that if a judge has made a determination – first of all of the people held on pretrial detention are under our legal system innocent. Mm-hmm. They haven't been convicted of anything. No. Second of all, if a judge reaches the point where he or she has just determined your bail is $2,000, that means the judge has said – you can go home. It's okay for you to go home. Mm-hmm. There is no prohibition. There's been no determination that you are such a danger to your community that you should be held until your case is over. By saying you are eligible for bail, they're saying you can go home. The only question left is, do you have enough money? Obviously, this only penalizes poor people, and in St. Louis and in most urban areas, that only penalizes people of color. And that's something that we're really trying to change.
I've heard of something in this community, maybe it's the same elsewhere, called CA time, circuit attorney time. And that is that they don't mind having people, apparently don't mind having people sit.
Who doesn't mind? The individuals in? No,
the circuit attorney's
office. Oh, right. Yeah. I don't think prosecutors care if these folks are sitting in jail or not. It's to their advantage. It's here with Kim Gardner, with Bob McCulloch. It doesn't matter who it is. If they sit in jail pre-trial, that means it's more likely that those folks are going to plead guilty. That's another thing that getting them out can avoid, is people pleading guilty when they haven't done the crime, or when the state can't prove that they've done it, they're more likely to come and plead guilty or plead to a more serious offense than they would if they were out and able to tend to their families and their children and their loved ones and get back to work and keep their housing. Yeah, it's an obviously coercive lever that the state uses to produce the kind of guilty pleas that we see all across the country.
And because prosecutors all over the country, for the most part, are elected officials, it helps them to have a more scalps on their belt, if you will, of people that they have convicted.
Yeah, for people who've lost sense of what justice is, which I think is most prosecutors in this country, then, what they're talking about is law and order and convictions, and they have completely lost touch with the reality that these convictions destroy people's lives. Even this pretrial detention, 3 days of pretrial detention can destroy a person's life. From their point of view, they're making an argument to the court. This is the funny thing, is they're skipping many of the – they and the judges are skipping many of the steps that are supposed to be gone through to determine to hold someone. They're just using money as a proxy for every other consideration. So we're hoping that we're going to be able to do some public education and work with folks on this issue, but the consequences are devastating, obviously, to the people who are held pre-trial. It ends up, in addition to the inhumane and unethical aspects of this, there's a financial cost involved too. If people are only interested in the dollars, Dale Glass will tell you how much money it costs to keep somebody in jail who has a serious mental health problem or an addiction problem. The man who's in charge of the Louisville Correctional Center is a decent friend of mine, and he is among the biggest advocates in the country for releasing people pre-trial, because he knows that these folks are not a threat to their community, and what they need is serious care that can't be provided to them adequately in the jail.
What criteria would you be using to determine which people you would assist in getting out?
It's something that's still in development at this point, but because we're going to seek to partner with local jurisdictions, and we want to talk to them about what their needs are. So you can imagine in a certain jurisdiction there may be overrepresented members of a community who are facing immigration issues, and they might want to prioritize folks with those issues. There may be a high population of folks who are transgender who are being misgendered in the jail, or the jail doesn't have adequate facilities, and we may want to focus on prioritizing them. We're not going to use some of the language that is being commonly used these days about a risk assessment. In our view, what we're talking about is needs for most people, and we're gonna approach this as, do you have connections to family and community and a support network that could get you out? We work with a lot of folks who are experiencing homelessness, so we know at Arch City Defenders that someone may not have a physical address they go to, but we know where they're going at noon every day to grab a meal, and we know we have a sense of where they're going to lay their head at night, even if they're unsheltered. And for those folks who have some connections that we're aware of, we're going to work with those folks because we want to get them out of jail as soon as possible.
What about those who are being charged with more violent crimes or breaking gun laws, that sort of thing?
It's not something that we have a prohibition against at this moment. Again, this is going to depend on the communities that we go to. I think there is a practical consideration when, even though we are lucky to have a lot of money, we don't have unlimited money. So if you look at the bails that are set on people who have very serious crimes that they're charged with, they're going to be $100,000, which will deplete a community bail fund instantly if we were to bail one person out on that versus 100 people on a $1,000 bond. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly going to be an effort to balance the needs of the broader community.
And how large a group – we'll get to Arch City Defenders in just a second.
Sure.
How large a group of this is going to be in 40 cities, did you say?
40 cities. We're going to hire what we're calling bail disruptors to try to disrupt and ultimately destroy the cash bail system. Mm-hmm. We're looking for people who are from local communities, and we are trying to put forth every effort to hire people who are formerly incarcerated. Some jurisdictions don't allow people who are formerly incarcerated to post bail for others. If they can – then what we're trying to do is get people who are directly impacted by this system to help bail people out and then get those folks connected to movements and reform efforts in the broader community.
Okay. Well, it sounds like a very, very interesting program.
Yeah,
certainly be watching that locally, needless to say. Thomas Harvey, let's talk about Arch City Defenders and your 8 years, I guess it's been now, since you've been involved with that organization. I'll work backwards this time because I want to learn more about your successor. Someone has already been selected and someone homegrown.
Yes, Blake Strode. We're extraordinarily lucky to have Blake to succeed me at Arch City Defenders. And I think even more importantly than Blake's incredible leadership skills is that my co-founder, Michael John Voss, and I have been talking about leadership succession for 3 years. And I think, you know, in most nonprofits, it would be natural for co-founder to replace co-founder. And Michael John and I made a decision several years ago that we weren't going to go that way. And I just I value and love Michael John for his grace and humility and his ability to say it's better for the organization if Blake run it, and MJ is going to stay on at the organization and take a senior litigator position, and he's not going to have to be doing as many accounting and finance things that I've been asking him to do these last handful of years. He's going to take a more active role in litigation. So it's great for us all around. Jackie Langham, who's there, who joined us from Legal Services, is staying as well, and she's our director of advocacy. And Blake, Jackie, and MJ are going to form an executive committee that's going to be functionally operating the organization with Blake at the head.
And Michael John, by the way, is going to be our guest on a legal roundtable next Monday.
Excellent.
Okay. So it's Arch City Defenders Week or something like that. Very quickly, what is Blake's background?
So Blake is from St. Louis. He went to Pattonville High School. He played tennis there. He then went to University of Arkansas to pursue tennis and I think a business degree in undergrad. And then, like all of us, instead of just going out in the world and getting a job, he said, I'm going to see if I can play professional tennis for 3 years and simultaneously defer admission to Harvard Law School during that time so he could make a go of it on the professional tennis tour. So he's quite an exceptional person. And so he eventually went to Harvard, joined us as a Skadden Fellow, reached out to us after Mike Brown's murder and said he'd be interested in trying to come back to St. Louis and work with us. And one of the best qualities Blake had is, I mean, he's a natural leader, but he's also a very humble person. This is a person who's got, a Harvard Law degree, played professional tennis, and has come to St. Louis. And when he first joined us, he's in the prestigious Skadden Fellowship, and he's literally sharing a desk sitting like you and I are right now across the table from someone who's sharing his desk, and never batted an eye, helped us move offices, has fit in instantly from the beginning, and has taken a very slow, calm, steady, increased leadership role over the course of the last 2 years, and he's just ready for this position.
We're looking forward to meeting him. Hopefully that will be soon. We're talking with Thomas Harvey, the soon-to-be ex-executive director of the Arch City Defenders Organization. We'll come back and continue that conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org, or we'll also take a tweet at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back as we continue our conversation with Thomas Harvey of Arch City Defenders. Thomas, as you're preparing to leave, what's on the front burner right now with Arch City Defenders?
We just filed suit against the City of St. Louis for the conditions in the Medium Security Institute, the workhouse. This is actually an outgrowth of the work we did in collaboration with Kaylin Kennard and the bailouts over the summer. When we got those folks out, they started telling us about their experiences there. And over the course of the last 3 or 4 months, as we've interviewed more and more people, We really thought that it was important to file this lawsuit and to try to call for the closure of the workhouse. I think everybody in this community understands that this is an outdated facility. I think even if you talk to the DOC commissioner, they'll tell you that there's some serious infrastructure problems there. Those problems on paper are serious issues as they stand. But if you're in that facility awaiting trial, pretrial, innocent until proven guilty, these take on even more significance. So that's something that just happened this week, is at the front burner for us.
Are you satisfied with the way things have moved with regard to the post-Ferguson municipal court reform movement?
We've been on the show many times. I've never been satisfied with anything that's ever happened. It's no different now. Fundamentally, I still think that the courts in this region, and they're not unique across the country, they're not prepared to deal with the depths of poverty of the people who come before them. They're still trying to figure out a way to punish folks into compliance. And I'll keep saying this until the end of the time. You cannot punish people out of poverty. It doesn't matter if you're fining them or giving them community service or jailing them. You will never change their underlying circumstances so long as you approach it in that fashion. When they finally accept that their reason for contact with the municipal court or the legal system is as a result of their poverty, and like deeply accept that and understand that, then they're going to think about some other methods to try to help these folks instead of punishing them.
Well, we're getting some response from the audience to my request to bring them into the conversation, mostly emails at this point, but I'm backtracking just a bit here. We have Preston writing, "I just saw our city sue the workhouse for inhumane conditions, as you just discussed a moment ago. What can people in the community do to support your work?"
Obviously, we are an organization that exists primarily on donations. More than half of our budget is funded from individual members of the community giving as little as a dollar to people, you know, very generous donors in this community giving $50,000. Besides that, I would say that putting some public pressure on our elected officials about this jail and the conditions there is the most important thing you can do. Taking seriously the voices of the people who have been in that jail and experienced it, and not the folks who every once in a while go on a tour of it and see it in likely its best conditions. I think really just embracing embracing the stories of the people who spoke at our press conference, James Cody, and really understanding what it means to be locked in a jail and kept away from your children, and also subjected to inhumane conditions prior to any determination of guilt or innocence.
We have a call from Bill. He's in St. Louis. Bill, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. My comment is, speaking as a liberal from the city of St. Louis, I've heard other people use the term of Michael Brown as a murder. And it always kind of bothers me that they, you know, since all the information came out and the DOJ did not prosecute and so forth, but just the use of the word murder in a situation like that makes me a bit uncomfortable as a liberal. And so that's my comment.
Okay, thank you so much for the call. It's one we try to avoid. That word in that particular case.
I mean, I continue to use it. The people, the people we serve, the folks that we work with, use murder. It's the term that has most accurately describes the people that we work, how they feel about it. And the DOJ's reporting notwithstanding, I stand with the folks that we serve.
Okay. We'll move along. Taylor emails, "What has been Arch City's role in post-Stockley verdict protest movements?"
We haven't been involved in any kind of organization or protest. The folks who were frontline protesters in Ferguson have led that. Obviously, folks know Bruce Franks, but beyond Bruce, there's a lot of people who are not as high profile who are out there doing that work every day. We are representing people who've been arrested during those protests. We're representing people who were arrested after the kettling, arrested after the bridge incident. We're going to be engaged in the same way we have been with people who are arrested in Ferguson. We're going to take their individual cases. That's one of the things that Arch City Defenders does that, for example, the ACLU had a great decision the other day from the federal court and a finding by Judge Perry about the police conduct during the protests. The ACLU, though, doesn't represent people in their pending cases if they're being prosecuted by the state or the municipality. And so we represent people in their pending cases, their underlying cases, and we will bring civil rights litigation on their behalf.
A federal judge and a federal court, I should say, and the Board of Aldermen are now considering let me put that a little bit differently. The federal judge wants the police to revisit the way they handle protests.
Sure.
And the Board of Aldermen wants legislation to demand that.
Yeah. I mean, this sort of reminds me – one thing, it's indicative of how much things have changed since Ferguson, since Mike Brown was murdered, as I would say it. There wasn't as much legal activity around these issues. People were a little more slow to get in the game and to fight these things, and local elected officials were too. Now, I think 3 years later, after people have had that experience in Ferguson, they are quicker to get out there, and I think people have a better sense of some of the things that happen in Ferguson and in the city of St. Louis are just repeating themselves. It's an iteration of the same thing, and that's something that overall we at Arch City Defenders have been very sensitive to, is the way in which legislation by a Board of Aldermen or the state is really just sometimes represents a minor shift away from a previously horrific situation. So, for example, I like to say often that this is sometimes the difference in these policies is I was getting punched in the face and now I'm just getting punched in the stomach. And I'm glad you're not punching me in the face anymore, but I'd like you to stop hitting me overall, right? I mean, I'm paraphrasing the famous Malcolm X quote about this. Mm-hmm. But the fact is we don't have a whole lot of faith in the idea that legislation or litigation is really going to fundamentally transform these systems. It takes people being in the streets. It takes people organizing. It takes the collective efforts of all of us, and litigation and legislation are just tools.
Well, there hasn't been much legislation post Michael Brown.
No, there was one, SB5, and while that has certainly put the focal point on a lot of the municipal court issues that we had highlighted in our paper in 2014, I think, and I'm grateful for that. I'm excited about that. That bill made a big difference in a lot of people's lives. Mm-hmm. It's a great bill. I think people lose sight of the fact that there were roughly 15 bills proposed to attack police misconduct, and none of those passed. Yeah. So we're right back at it now, facing the same questions. We now got a federal judge telling us our police have got some serious issues. We had a chance to fix this in 2014, and we didn't. And I just don't have a whole lot of faith that we're going to fix it now either. I think, as we've pointed out repeatedly, and I think any person would tell you, if you just look at the municipal court reforms and the stuff that Judge Perry said the other day, these aren't new concepts. These are fundamental principles of law and law enforcement. They're being violated. They were always illegal. There's nothing new here. And so long as we have to have people, regular everyday folks, leading the way on what the reforms are going to be and keeping constant pressure on it.
These most recent protests, the current protests, seem different to me than those in the past, and I think you would agree with that. I wonder if being different, they have any better chance of success, of really causing change.
I think they've changed the conversation around that verdict. I think they've effectively disrupted the economics here. I think that, as with all protests, it creates a space for conversation about serious issues that otherwise wouldn't occur. That the judge's opinion of the work of the ACLU, Jeffrey Mittman and Tony Rothard, was great, and that's going to change the conversation again. That's only because of the people who went out in the streets, though. That litigation doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's not an academic exercise.
I wonder if the composition, the racial composition of the people who are protesting, is helping in that regard, because it's quite a mixed group now.
It is a mixed group. I would say that there's still black leadership in all these groups, and that's crucial. There are certainly more white folks and middle-class folks from around the region who have been involved and seem to better understand the issues at race. I do think that's a trajectory that you see coming out of Ferguson and coming up to today.
Let's take another call. We have John joining us from Franklin County. John, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. You hear me all right?
Sure do.
Great. I just wanted to thank Mr. Harvey. He's a man after my heart. I like his concept and what he's doing. My comment was, I've had the experience to work with a young man that got himself in a little trouble here and there, And I just feel that if there was any of these groups that, such as Mr. Harvey's, that could somehow screen advocates of and actually assign them to people out of the court system. This young man just needed somebody he could count on. And for the last 8 months, I've been with him most every other day at counseling and just going over the issues. And, you know, I'm not a professional in that term, but I've got 7 of my own children. But my experience has been that it seems that they just need somebody to care about them and give them a little attention, a little guidance. And I was wondering if there's such an organization that does such a thing where they screen the advocate and assign or have them, you know, do such a thing that I have done.
That's a great question. I appreciate that that sentiment. I think that's great. I think it goes to show something that we've always talked about at Arch City Defenders, which is the legal work we do is really important. But after the legal work, it's what folks really need. And Bronx Defenders has got civil advocates on their team who are not lawyers who do something akin to what John's describing. I'd also say, you know, so long as folks are thinking in that framework, recognize that that's what community organizers do also. They do a less formal version of it. It's not through the legal system. It's through communities, right? You go out and meet people, and through that building of networks, you suss out the actual baseline needs of people and see if you can help them. Sometimes that means taking somebody to court, taking somebody to a job interview. That's the kind of things that communities have always gotten together to do outside of a formal legal system or court system. And it'd be great if the court, you know, had some sort of civil legal advocates that were provided to folks, but we can do that on our own as well.
Well, Jimmy Edwards was trying to do something akin to that, I believe, during the time he was on the bench.
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's a subject for another time. But when you stop to think about it, a young person coming out of jail and really having no place to go, no family to speak of to go to, and no one to help, he's going to be right back in jail next thing you know.
Yeah, that might happen. That's one of the things that when Michael John and I and John McCanner started Arch City Defenders, that's one of the things that we saw social workers playing that role when we went to St. Patrick's Center when we were just 3 volunteers. I mean, we now have 20 people working at Arch City Defenders, but we were just 3 individuals who started Arch City Defenders with no funding. And the first thing we did was go to St. Patrick's Center and talk to the social workers and the caseworkers. And that's what they were doing. They were going out to court on people's behalf. Mm-hmm. They were taking people to job interviews. They were doing everything they could because they knew that even if they got someone, you know, somebody who was coming back from incarceration, that if they didn't get those kind of supports, that they were headed back that way. And we were intervening on a specific legal issue, but they were doing the other work.
Yeah. An email here from Cora writes, what advice would you give to lawyers who want to get involved with Arch City Defenders, and what can lawyers in St. Louis and beyond do to support your mission?
So if you want to get involved, just email me. You can email tharvey@archcitydefenders.org, and we can try to coordinate opportunities to get involved. I am going to be a broken record and say donate to Arch City Defenders. You can find it on our website, which is just archcitydefenders.org. We do rely heavily on donations, and we need that even more now. There's a $6 billion proposed cut at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which is I think it's 15 or 17% of our overall budget comes from that funding to provide direct services. In addition to that, lawyers can help us with our caseload if they've got the opportunity to do that, the kind of flexibility to do that. We do such a variety of work that civil rights lawyers, class action lawyers, people who have a lot of experience would be valuable to us. We are a group of relatively young and new lawyers. I think Jackie Langham is probably the most experienced lawyer, and that's going on 11 years of experience. So We can always use some help, and we're always looking for people who are willing to share their experience and guidance with us.
I'm going to take one more phone call for Thomas Harvey. Marvin in St. Louis, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hey, Thomas, how are you? This is Judge Tier from Louisville.
Hi.
I used to be in city court with you.
Hey, how are you doing, Judge?
First of all, I want to commend you on everything that Arch City Defenders has done. You've been a great soldier in this struggle, but I'm curious, after all of this work that we've done, and I don't know if you've addressed this because I didn't hear all of the program, how optimistic you are, Thomas, about our future. I love our city and our community, but I have to believe that the glass is half full, that we're all able to change and understand the space and place that each of us as citizens occupy. And I'll take my comment off the air. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Judge. I appreciate that. I had addressed it before, and I'm not a person who's satisfied with progress very often. I always push for more. I would say that there have been some important changes. I think we've got a whole new generation of Black leaders who are coming into important roles in this community. I have a lot of faith in that. I respect and admire the work of Kayla Reed and Michelle Higgins and Kennard Williams, and I'm hopeful that we're going to be able to take some leadership and some guidance from these folks and continue to give them place and space to help develop policies. I'm hoping that we're going to be able to continue to push St. Louis in the right direction. It's an uphill battle, though, and St. Louis isn't the only place, but we've got a lot of people in this community who've done hard work that we can draw from if we listen to them.
Well, Thomas Harvey, we also wish you well. We're going to have to end our conversation right here. Hopefully we'll get together before you leave in January. But again, congratulations on your new life, and we wish you well, as I say.
Thank you so much.
Outgoing Executive Director of Arch City Defenders. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.